Welcome to After Hours. I'm playing Steve Goodman all night tonight because Steve Goodman plays a part, a small part, albeit because he didn't play baseball, in the Chicago Cubs. Story of a Curse by my friend Rich Cohn, who is in studio with me, will be in town for a few days. It's a fabulous book. One thing you write in the, and Rich has been all over the place. He had a wonderful piece about the guy and woman who inspired the movie The Natural and the novel The Natural, which I still think of Bernard Malamud's best novel. And his first novel. That's my, that may be the best first novel ever written.
Yeah.
Eddie Waitkus, who got shot at the Edgewater Beach Hotel. He also has a piece, had a piece a couple days ago, one day ago, in the New York Times, an opinion piece, the title of which is What the Cubs Could Teach the President. And he details what the Cubs could teach the president. But what, one of the sentences he writes in here is, what we want for a president is a person who grew up in the bleachers of Wrigley Field, learning humility and loss, the fleeting nature of glory. That is the story of the Chicago Cubs, is it not, Rich?
Yeah, well, I was went to my first Cubs game in 1976.
You were eight.
Yeah, I was born in 68 with my father, who was from New York and was a Yankees fan. We watched the Cubs have a big lead to Cincinnati Reds. We watched that lead evaporate. It was the first time I saw a drunk grown-up and a heckler. And on the way home, my father said to me, I want you to make me a promise. I want you to promise me not to be a Cubs fan. He goes, look at me. I'm a Yankees fan. I expect to win. Look at these Cubs fans. They expect to lose. If you're a Cubs fan, you'll accept losing as a natural order of the world, and you'll have a diminished life as a result.
You fought against that advice. So
well,
you couldn't.
I did what a kid had. The only self-respecting thing you can do is become the biggest Cubs fan in the world, which is what happened.
You went to your first game when you were 13, right?
Well, I went to my first game when I was
alone.
Alone. Well, that was the great thing about Wrigley Field, which is people said, why a Cubs fan and not a White Sox fan? I grew up on the North Shore. But you could Cubs played in the daytime, and we were allowed to basically go, or if not allowed, we snuck out and could get on the train and go to Wrigley Field and be kind of free. And what was happening in the bleachers was just as important as what was happening on the field at the time.
You know, you do a great job. You beautifully describe and I think this will hit the hearts of everybody listening out there. You're talking about the first game you went to when you were eight, and you said, and I'm sure this remained true, and I think it remains true whether someone has gone to the game for 60 years. My favorite part was emerging from the tunnel. The field stretched before me as the grasslands must have stretched before the first trapper to make it beyond the Alleghenies. Is that still true for you?
Going into a magic egg or something. Yeah. It's like this tremendous space right in the middle of the city. You're completely surprised by it every single time, and every single time it's like you're 8 years old again.
When the Cubs were – you've written about the Cubs. You wrote an amazing piece that I still remember in Harper's many years ago about the Cubs. I mean, you have written about the Cubs before. When, during last season, did you get the notion or the wake up screaming at the notion that the Cubs might actually win the World Series?
Well, I really realized at first when Theo Epstein got hired. I was working on a book about the 85 Bears.
Yeah, sure.
And I was banging,
Monsters of the Midway. That's a great book,
Right, and I was banging on the door of Jim McMahon in Scottsdale, Arizona to interview him. And the door flew open, and McMahon was wearing a shirt that said, got milk, and it said, no, got pot. He had a big thing of chewing tobacco in his mouth, and he grabbed me, and he pulled me inside. I'd never met him before, and he said, we're going to win the World Series. Theo is coming. That's how I started with McMahon. And, of course, I knew what Theo Epstein had done.
In
Boston, and his sort of genius. So I was watching the Cubs in a different way. And then by 2015, when they started bringing all those young players up, this is a different team, different kind of team. And there was a moment where I had an epiphany because my theory is every Cubs fan has the team that broke their heart.
Sure.
The team that crushed them and they could never love in the same way again. For me, it was the 84 Cubs and losing to San Diego Padres. And of course, I'd known about the 69 Cubs and everything. And when I started watching that team Theo Epstein put together, I'm like, oh, so this is what it was. This is how good you have to be. You have to be incredibly good.
Yeah.
At like every position with redundancy at many positions. And in 2015, I went to Sports Illustrated and I said, send me to Chicago and let me just sit in the bleachers for a week and write about it like when I was a kid. And they said, well, you don't have a big budget for this. I'm like, I don't even want any money. Yeah. But when the Cubs get to the World Series, give me a press pass
to
the playoffs.
Give me a pass, yeah. Wise move. It was a very shrewd kind of financial move for a writer.
It's an act. Well, yeah. Because you understand, I'm a big believer in the jinx like everybody. Don't want to jinx the Cubs.
Yeah.
But I was so carefully observing the jinx for like 40 years, and the Cubs kept losing. Last year, I was like a George Costanza movement. Let me do the opposite of everything I've been doing. Let me jinx the Cubs. So I called the hotel in Chicago and said, I want to book a room in, you know, October. They're like, coming in for business. Like, no, I'm coming in to watch the Cubs play in the World Series, which they will be doing in October.
Well, they say we'll give you a free room. They should have said that. They should have said that. The first Cubs team that you fell in love with was the 79 Cubs. It was the first team you followed. The first team you fell in love with. Tell me about the 79 Cubs.
Right. Well, I realized when the Cubs won the World Series that my kids are going to have this crazy idea that the Cubs are a great baseball team. Mm. And the experience of being the Cubs fan means being in the thick of the action all the time. And that's not really, to me, the Cubs fan experience. The Cubs fan experience is 1979. And that was sort of a sub-500 team that had one truly transcendent player, Bill Buckner.
Yeah.
And if you're a Cubs fan, the Cubs would usually give you that one great player you could latch your dreams onto, and it was almost like I always felt the Cubs were making their way through the wilderness trying to get to the promised land, and we needed one guy to carry us, and that was like the Mr. Cub. Yeah. And really, Ernie Banks established that.
Yeah, defined it.
Defined it. He is the guy who showed how it's done, and we would get that guy. You know, we would get Buckner, and then we'd get Sandberg, or we'd get, you know, Mark Grace, or whoever it was. And also on the 79 Cubs was, to me, kind of the anti-Ernie Banks. That was Dave Kingman,
yeah.
Who is known as King Kong. Also
sure.
Ding Dong,
yep.
Who would hit those 600-foot home runs and then have the biggest strikeouts you'd ever seen, and who seemed to dislike not only the media but the fans.
True.
And I always felt like,
true,
this guy doesn't like me. I mean, not in general. He somehow knows me, knows about me, and doesn't like me. Then there was also Rick Rushel was on that team, and Steve Onoveros, and Barry Foote. I mean,
yeah.
And Mike Vail, who I convinced my brother, Vail, Colorado, was named after, the only time I ever fooled my brother.
But this is not the most, the 79 team was not, and even Buckner included, was hardly the most charismatic team.
No, but they're the team that when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
And when
yeah.
you're 10 years old, that's when everything is
imprinted. You don't know from charisma, yeah.
And everything is compared to that. And mm-hmm. so for me, every team after that was, and like you said, it was not a charismatic team at all,
yeah.
but it had Bill Buckner. And Bill Buckner, you know, there's a crazy quote that Bill Buckner gave, and I wanted to try to find it, and I did for this book, which is he won the batting title, I think, in 1980, and he compared himself to Santiago and the old man in the sea, bringing in the giant fish, and then the sharks come and eating the fish. Mm. I mean, that's how the guy saw himself.
Well, also, it's rare to have a literary reference for most ball players.
I know, that's what's amazing.
That is amazing. Rich Cohn is in here to talk mostly about the Chicago Cubs, story of a curse. There is a big party on Wednesday at Where Else, the Billy Goat, right after work, where you can meet Rich and buy the book and have him autograph it and ask him whatever questions. I don't really ask questions. We just have a conversation up here. We'll take a little break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk a little Maria Sharapova, and also a little about his first book, a book called Tough Jews, which I think is one of the most magnificent nonfiction books ever written. How's that? Steve Goodman, in honor of Rich Cohn, who mentioned Steve in his new book. I will tell you this, and it is not a commercial for Rich. It's Play Ball, Celebrate the Cubs with Team Memorabilia, exclusive books, and so much more. Visit ChicagoTribune.com. Visit the internet, any of those buy a book sites, and get Rich's book, The Chicago Cubs Story of a Curse. And one of the things that distinguishes all of Rich Cohn's books is his personal, he is not loath to share himself in the pages of his books. He did it in one of his most recent books, Monsters, the 85 Chicago Bears and the Wild Heart of Football. He did it in his recent Rolling Stones book. You've got quite a bookshelf there. I don't remember if you did it in Tough Jews, which was your first book.
Yeah.
You did. Of course you did. Yeah, of course you did. In this one, you do share yourself Your admiration for the Ricketts is, I'm not going to use the word profound, but is pretty high.
Well, it's like the guy showing up, you know, and cutting the Gordian knot. Yeah. Alexander, you know, no one can undo this knot, and Alexander the Great comes and just cuts it in half. You know, so a problem that seems unsolvable is then solved. You end up admiring that, and changes a lot of people's lives, you know. And the reason why I have myself in it is because I feel like, well, there's a kind of reporter that tells you, like, what happened, which
sure.
is important. And then there's what it felt like,
uh-huh.
which is just as much part of it. And I'm as good of an example as a Cubs fan as anyone, I believe.
No question.
And I've been up and down with it, and I've been through hell with it and everything. And just what it means to sort of finally win that World Series. And also the sort of how it's like kind of bittersweet.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you're older, because the feeling is, you know, being a Cubs fan, the identity was, like, I always thought, our kingdom is not of this world, you know. We've escaped your small ideas of profit and loss. We know that the team that wins this year is going to lose next year, and life goes on, and there's other things, you know, and you can enjoy August because October's never coming and you're not going to be here.
Right.
You know, so all that changes.
One of the interesting things about the book, the afterword, is to me fascinating. You write, if this were the ultimate Cubs book, it would have included several people and events that I either had and cut or never had at all, because a book is finite, but the Cubs go on forever. Ronnie Woo Woo, for instance, does not have a chapter to himself.
Right,
in
but
this
I mentioned
book.
Him
Thank
in
God.
The
yes, you do. Yes, you do. You mentioned a lot of things. A lot of, yeah, if Ronnie Woo Woo, here's how you mention him. This book would have had Ronnie Woo Woo Wickers, a self-fashioned ultimate Cubs fan who spent year after year in the bleachers chanting, Cubs woo, Cubs woo, Cubs woo, or if the team was about to sweep, sweep woo, sweep woo, sweep woo. Asked how I guarantee you, Rich Cohn, Ronnie will be at the Billy Goat for your book party on, he occasionally does drop in on Wednesday at about 5 o'clock.
I'm going to try to get him to chant bestseller woo, bestseller woo.
You concentrated on some fascinating, not concentrated, devote too much time to. DeRocher obviously fascinates you, as he always has fascinated me. He is a relatively main character in the book, is he not?
Right, well, because DeRocher is like the kind of guy who just jumps off the page.
Yeah.
Because it's like an exclamation point has broken off the page and is floating around the world. He's like a lightning bolt, you know? And just him growing up in Springfield, Massachusetts, kind of a pool shark. And he's the guy who stole Babe Ruth's watch or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he shows up at the Yankees and he's what Doug Plank told me. Doug Plank described to me the Bears about Ditka. He was talking, but I realized that it perfectly is applicable to DeRocher. Is there's three kind of coaches. There's the aspirin coach who sort of fixes nothing.
Right.
There's the penicillin coach. He said who fixes everything except the one thing they can't fix, which is cancer. Cancer
and
on a
chemo.
Team.
That's when you bring in the chemotherapy.
Bring in the chemotherapy coach, who's like Mike Ditka. He said, or like DeRocher. And he said the problem is a chemotherapy coach kills the cancer on the team, which like guys not trying and stuff. But then he keeps using the chemo machine. He starts killing healthy tissue because he's got a chemo machine.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened with the Bears, and that's what happened with to some extent with that Cubs team. And one of the crazy stories is what the 69 Cubs. In 70, 71, 72. Because when a team is that good as they really were.
Oh, they were, sure.
I mean, I think five of them are in the Hall of Fame, and they're all-stars at one point, and they don't win. It's like, what happens when you're supposed to win and you should win, you collapse and you don't win? And it's like, I just remember this, like, rip open your chest and show each other your cowardly hearts. I mean, they can't go on together anymore. And that's when I grew up without realizing it. I always thought I was like a kid growing up, like, in the provinces of Rome. In like 1200, there'd been this mighty empire, which was the 69 Cubs. I didn't know they were there. But every now and then I'd be digging in the garden and I'd find a bust of Marcus Aurelius or something.
What were, Rich Cohn, in digging deep? I know this, you know, this is not a book that you wrote off the top of your head. You've done a lot of research for this thing. It is based in part on your life and memories. But what were some revelations? I mean, one of the interesting ones for me is everybody. You mentioned Cubs and curse, and they will react goat. That is not the only curse. But what, as you write in the book, what were the revelations in doing this book for you?
First of all, that the curse is real, okay? It's not a metaphysical magical curse, but a curse is like a bad culture at a business. It spread from generation to generation. Then there's no resilience. When things go wrong, everybody just sort of falls back on the curse, like here it is. And even though you don't believe in it, every manager that would come to the Cubs, they'd be asked about the curse. They'd say, I don't believe in the curse.
Sure.
But it's like if you don't believe in ghosts, but you stay in a house that you've been told is haunted and you hear something in the middle of the night, you're scared anyway. You know? And yeah. I really saw that at that the famous Bartman game, watching TV, because the look in the eyes of Dusty Baker, who'd won World Series with the Dodgers, and was the look in his eyes, I knew exactly what he was thinking, was, oh, my God, it's real. There's a curse.
Nah.
Because the way the team just seemed to fall apart, and it happened in 84, and when they won last year, okay, and the game was tied up.
And the rain came.
And I was at the game, and I was in shock. And I turned to the guy next to me, I was in the press box, and I said, well, at least we're still winning. He said, it's tied. And I said, no, it's not. He goes, look at the scoreboard. I go, there's something wrong with the scoreboard. And I called my wife when the Cubs were ahead. And I said, so if the Cubs win, that means there was never a curse? She's like, I've never seen better evidence of a curse in my life. This is a team. It shows you how good you have to be to fight off the curse. It's like watching somebody with the flu trying to get out of bed, you know. Thing keeps enwrapping them, and they keep getting back and getting back on their feet.
What team? You have kids. You live out east. What teams do your kids root for?
Cubs, Bears. Now, it's weird because I didn't root for my father's teams. You know?
Yeah, you didn't root for the Yankees or Giants.
Blackhawks.
Really?
Yeah.
Very
and I'm trying to think
father.
If they root for any New York teams. I live in the New York area. I can't think of any.
That's great.
They root for That's Northwestern. Great. You know, and they're watching Northwestern play Michigan. But I was sitting there one day when the Cubs were really, a couple years ago, and they looked really bad, and they're all wearing their Cubs jerseys, and we're sitting around watching the Cubs getting killed. And I think, what's wrong with me? What am I doing?
Dad, like, don't do this
I'm
to
I'm going
to
abuse child abuse.
Well, at least they didn't start crying. They didn't start crying. One other thing, in the after, I think it was after your Harper's Magazine piece, I think, that long piece in Harper's. What was that thing titled? Do you remember?
Down and Out at Wrigley Field.
You wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal under the headline, which I found fascinating and fascinating to reread about in the book, Why Wrigley Field Must Be Destroyed.
Yeah. Well, basically, the whole idea of the Harper's piece was, I'm going to figure out why the Cubs can't win. Mm-hmm. Cubs spend money. The Cubs get great players. They bring in the best people, but they can't win. So I went on the road with the Cubs for a couple weeks, and they lost 7 games in a row.
I know.
And I'm like, and when you go into the clubhouse after the 7th straight loss, you don't want to be there. It's like being in a sick room. It's miserable, and you feel really nasty asking questions, you know. So I'm like, I can't handle this. I got to get out of here. So I flew back to Chicago, and I interviewed the general manager, which is Larry McPhail.
Yeah.
I always mix up the McPhails. There's so many of them. And I asked him, you know, finally I said, listen, why can't they win? And he said, well, I can tell you, but you're not going to like it. I'm like, come on. I want the truth. I'm a reporter. He's like, you're going to yell at me. I'm like, I'm not going to yell at you.
Yell at you, yeah.
He's in like, a mostly right, meaningless regular season
don't
finale.
Don't scream at me. And he said, it's Wrigley Field. And he laid out this whole case, which I'd never heard, though I, at that time, this was like 1999, about how Wrigley Field is schizophrenic and you can't build a team for it. Like you can build a team for Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park. So you need kind of an all-around great team, almost
right.
like an all-star
right.
team. And if you looked at it, the Cubs had been like the greatest team in baseball right up until they moved into Wrigley Field, and then they never won another World Series. And the only team to win a championship in Wrigley Field was the Bears. And I didn't write that in the Harper story because it felt like, how can I say that about Wrigley Field? But it just weighed on me and weighed on me and weighed on me. And I made the case in Harper's, and I kind of went, in a moment of pain, went over the top and said, look, the only solution is tear down Wrigley Field. Put salt in the ground so nothing can grow at that address again. Take the ruins out to someplace in the country and burn them. And it was like it was kind of joking, basically, of course.
Well,
but
people didn't get the
people
joke.
People got mad at me. I mean, it was so over the top. It was obviously a joke.
Obviously, right.
But,
right.
you know. So,
well, you write, when the piece was published, I was called a traitor and a fool, vilified, cut up, handed out, eaten, and digested. It hurt because I love Wrigley Field and the team.
Right. And when people call me a fool, which they will do now and then, my reaction is always the same. I am a fool.
Yeah. I love the Cubs.
I embrace that, yeah.
Have your kids been the games at Wrigley Field?
Yes, that year in 2015 that I wanted to go sit in the bleachers, before I went, we all came and we went and saw a series against the Cardinals. And we even got to sit behind an obstructed view seat, which we got the full experience.
Wow, that's really good. That's really good. Rich Cohn is my guest. I'm going to keep him for about another 15 minutes. He is the author of a substantial bookshelf full of books. You can go to author Rich Cohn. I'm not going to insult you by spelling that for you. AuthorRichCohn.com to hear about the Cubs book. You can also come to the Billy Goat. Are you making a presentation there? You're just going to shoot the breeze with people?
I'll talk for a couple minutes about the book and then, just hang out and talk Cubs and eat cheeseburgers and drink Pepsis.
It's a nice bar, ladies and gentlemen. You can trust me on that.
Here's a song for the Grand Canyon. Wrote this song after I walked to the bottom of the Grand Canyon in 1975. Just got back.
Well, it's always nice to hear Steve Goodman, whose affection for the Cubs was very deep and who's quoted in Rich Cohn's latest book. I don't know if this is your latest book. You have two books out simultaneously. The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse. Rich is also the author of Monsters. He's also the author of Tough Jews. He's also the author of the Banana King book? What is the name?
Fish That Ate the Whale.
Oh, my God, that's another great book. He has a great... Go to his website, authorrichcohn.com. I have raved about his books before I even met him after reading his first, Tough Jews. There's a nice piece in the Tribune by Josh Knoll about the book. So go online, Josh Knoll, Rich Cohn, find the story. Or if you really have newspapers at home, just dig through a couple days' old newspapers. Rich will be at the Billy Goat, the oldest of the Billy Goats, which is on a rarefied address of 430 North Michigan, but it's actually lower Michigan. It's on Hubbard Street, to talk about and sign the book and, take pictures with Sam Sianis and the rest of the family. And he will not drink a horny goat, which is one of the legendary drinks that they have at the thing. Another book that he has recently written, Unstoppable, My Life So Far, collaborating with Maria Sharapova, made it in its first week onto the New York Times bestseller list today. How did that come about, Rich?
She was interested in writing a book. And here's how it happened. She wanted to write her book, and she read the book I wrote with Jerry Weintraub. I'm not normally like a ghostwriter. It's not something
right,
I do.
Right, of course.
Jerry Weintraub.
Could you turn down? Nobody has ever turned down Jerry Weintraub.
Well, if you do, he just asks you again. He'll keep asking. The only way to get him to stop asking is to say yes. That's how he got Brad Pitt to do Ocean's 13. He asked him 2,000 times and realized the only way out of this is to do it.
Yeah.
Jerry Weintraub, I was sent by Vanity Fair to write a story about him, and we just sort of...
Oh, you hit it off, yeah.
Yeah, we became very close. One of the important people in my life, and I wrote this book called When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead with Jerry. And she read that book. And she wanted to write her own book, and she said, well, what about me? And I was sort of between stuff, and I met her in New York, and I really, really liked her. And I thought it was really interesting for my part to be able to sort of tell what it's like to be an athlete at that level in the first person with information you never normally get.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're not with reporters. They're not open like that. Like, what are you really thinking? And a bunch of the stuff that I thought was fascinating made huge news. Like, there's a story in the book, which she told me right away, where it was why Serena Williams is so motivated when playing,
Yeah.
And it was when she was 17 years old, Maria, she beat Serena at Wimbledon and then went back into the clubhouse a moment earlier than she should have and sort of came upon Serena crying hysterically, which, by the way, that's something they all do. I mean, I hung out with Andre Agassi at the Australian Open, and he lost a warm-up tournament to Patrick Rafter, and he was crying in the locker room after. So it's nothing against Serena. It's so intense and emotional. I think that afterwards the release is so great that it has to come out some way.
The challenge for you as an author, as a co-author, and you did a magnificent job with Jerry Weintraub, I have yet to read the Sharapova book, is to, it's one thing to talk to somebody. It's another thing to discover and be able to translate what is actually their voice onto a page, because people don't write the way they talk.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And by the way, sometimes people have asked me to ghostwrite books, and I sit with them, and I'm like, I can't do it because Jerry Weintraub was easy because he talks exactly like my father. Okay? And that voice is actually in my head all day going, hey, don't be a schmuck. What are you doing? Why are you doing that? That's stupid what you're doing. Put that back. And that's how Jerry would be.
Yeah.
You know? I have this story right now in Vanity Fair about Jared Kushner, and I have a quote in it from Jerry where Jerry said, what? You want a Harvard diploma? You want a Harvard diploma with your name on it? Give me 24 hours. I'll have you a Harvard diploma with your name on it.
What about writing in a woman's voice? I mean, was that in any way particularly challenging, or am I making too much of that?
Well, no, because it was collaborating. So wherever I messed that up, I figured she would fix it. I mean, I would write it and she would fix it and we'd work on it together. And that's what happened. And to me, the thing about her voice I thought I could do is the thing that people miss about Maria Sharapova is she's funny.
Yeah. And she's thoughtful, too.
And she's funny. And I thought you could almost do like a voice from like kind of an old J.D. Salinger story. I mean, the way, you know, if you want to hear about all the rest of that crap, you know, that's kind of how she talks. And from the first moment I met her, she was cracking me up. And she's got great stories about life on the tennis tour that you'd never normally have access to.
In some cases, and certainly not with Weintraub, and it sounds not with Sharapova either, a co-author has to play the role almost of psychiatrist and drag things out. It doesn't sound like that was the case with either of these two, was it?
I don't inspire that kind of confidence in people. They know that I'm probably in worse shape than they are. They wind up usually... Jerry wound up being my, you know, psychiatrist. So, these are people that are ready to tell their stories, and that's why. And Jerry had these stories. It was like they were almost stories he'd been telling for years, and I just had to sort of put them translate them onto the page. But Jerry's, you know, like one of the funniest guys in the world, and every time the movie The Firm is on, I just turn it on hoping to see Jerry because he plays Sonny Capps in that movie.
Yeah. He also was remarkably beloved, was he not? Even by his wife, with whom he didn't live all the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And by all of the new Brat Pack or whatever you want to call the, you know, George Clooney.
Because Jerry seemed like a connection to old Hollywood. And he was really a guy that completely was self-made. And he's a guy who had a dream when he was young and nothing. And in his dream, he saw a neon sign that said, Jerry Weintraub presents Elvis.
Yeah.
And he called Colonel Tom Parker and said, I want to take Elvis on tour.
How much did Parker want? You come up with $1 million or whatever?
Well, he had to call him every day for a year. And then finally, probably just like Brad Pitt saying, the only way to get this guy off my back is to do what he wants, is he said, if you can give me a check for $1 million, and it's got to be a cashier's check, tomorrow at noon, you can take Elvis on the road. And when I wrote the story, I wrote, you know, he met him at the roulette table. No, he met him at the craps table, and that was Jerry's. Like, it was a roulette table because roulette is a sucker's game, and that's what
the
colonel
played.
Oh,
funny!
He took him on the road, and he tells a story where the colonel, they have all this money from the merchandising in bags, and he dumps it on a table and takes a cane, and just divides it in half and goes, "That half yours, that half mine, fair."
Mm.
And that's how his career began.
You are enjoying I have to believe you're enjoying the reception of the Chicago Cubs story of a curse. I mean, this is...
Yeah, listen, you take a huge risk.
I agree.
When you write about anything that you truly love and is important to you.
Yeah.
Because if you mess it up, or if people feel like you messed it up, or you messed it up as far as you can ruin it.
Yeah.
You kind of take away something that you love. And so I'm very happy that it seems like people feel like I got it, and it is, this experience is an experience millions and millions and millions of us have lived.
Well, and also across the country, too. I mean, the Cubs are. I mean, I know that the Dallas Cowboys were once America's team. But if there's any team that is America's team,
Dallas Cowboys are not America's team.
No,
that's a slogan. The Cubs
never
really
was.
Right. And I watch, you know, with something I couldn't do in the past because the MLB app, I watched every Cubs game this year pretty much. Maybe not every inning of every game.
Yeah.
Because I got in trouble, but as much as I could watch.
Because you have children and a wife,
But what's amazing is the crowd is always chanting more as loudly for the Cubs And it's not just because they won the World Series. Because when
no,
I went,
no, they've been doing this for forever.
Because WGN was everywhere.
Sure.
And when I went on the road with them in 2000, 1999, we go to Arizona, and there were more Cubs fans there than
no question.
Yeah,
no question. Rich Cohn, the bookshelf keeps getting larger, but richer too. The Chicago Cubs story of a curse. Rich Cohn's the author. AuthorRichCohen.com is the website. The Maria Sharapova book is titled Unstoppable, My Life So Far. If you forget that, pick up your New York Times and look at the bestseller list because it's on there this week. Always good to see you. I'll see you down at the Billy Goat, 5 o'clock
Fantastic.
Wednesday. And welcome back home.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a couple minutes.